So after over 3 years of doing more than this, we will be closing down the podcast over the next few months. To end the show, we are going to bring back some of our favorite guests and sprinkle in a few people we've always wanted to talk to. We're calling these our exit interviews. Look for these exit interviews to drop intermittently over the next few months. We'll let you know when the final episode airs. Thanks so much for listening. You're listening to More Than This, the podcast where Christian faith and reason explore reasons for Christian faith. Life is not a sequence programmed from the sky, but it's a story woven up, down, in and out, like the stitches in a... If you enjoy our show, please consider supporting us for as little as $1 a month on Patreon. Check out our site at www.patreon.com/morethanthispod. Thank you. We are officially in the off-ramp for More Than This. This is an installment of the exit interviews. So as you've heard in the header by now, Brooke and I will be winding down this podcast over the course of the next few months, but we wanted to go out with a bang. So we're getting some of our favorite folks to come back from our history and chat with us one more time, because that's what this podcast has always been about, just getting to have the conversations that we want to have with the people we want to talk to. So excited today. Brooke is here. She'll be playing panelist and interviewer, sort of. So, and then our friend Rachel Jones is back with us. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, glad to be here.
So Rachel talked politics in a surprisingly non-contentious episode early in the pandemic, I think. But today we wanted to take a moment, and I'm going to be interviewing Brooke and Rachel a little bit about their experiences in different institutions. So in our a little recording studio today, we have people who are well-versed in working in the halls of government, military, and the church. So we're going to talk about sexual discrimination, harassment, gender bias, sort of experiences of women in these institutions. I thought it was just a really unique opportunity to sit down with people who have occupied these different areas of power. So power, I'll say power.
Influence.
Yes. They're both powerful when you talk to them. I will say that for sure. So let's start with I want to get some impressions from the women in the room. I'm really sensitive to like not speaking on behalf of women or pretending to understand this issue in any sort of firsthand manner. But I think you would have to have lived under a fairly large rock to not in the last 5 or 6 years realize that things are changing in the landscape of gender relations and dynamics in terms of there's been a lot of light cast on the experiences of women in a lot of these positions that where men have misabused their power, things like that, or there's a boys club culture, things like that. And we've obviously heard things like the hashtag Me Too at this point and some of the lawsuits that have come out of that as well. So I want to start by just getting some general reactions as women to seeing some of the events of the last like 5 to 7 years play out, and just kind of give me your off the cuff experience of what you've been sort of monitoring within yourself and noticing. Have you been cheering? Have you been taking pause at some of the things that have come forward in this time, or how have you kind of responded as you've seen these things play out, and what kind of conversations have you had with some of your female friends during this time? So anybody can lead out.
I think for me, one of the initial reactions I had was a lot of shock, I think, to some of the particular stories. But what it created in me was this opportunity to then ask people, has this been your experience? Have you had these experiences of harassment or sexual bias or things like this? And then hearing from friends, yes, and this is what happened. Yes, and this is what happened. So it kind of felt like it took the lid off a can, that it allowed even me as a woman to hear the stories of other women in a different way. It allowed me to know something to ask about. That was a really interesting result of that time and the time we're still living in. Like, is this actually true? Are these just really dramatic stories? And then hearing more and more variations of these stories from my friends. Wow. Okay.
And I guess as a man too, I'll corroborate like this. It's very interesting because if it's outside of your personal experience, you're kind of wondering, is this universally true? Is this very idiosyncratic to like a few people? How, how much faith can we put in these accounts? And then hearing, and I know you'll have some experiences that I want you to share as well as we further the conversation. Curious, Rachel, how these things struck you, and how have you sat with some things that maybe haven't been within your experience as a woman?
So I've been an active like layperson, volunteer, churchgoer, but I've never been employed by the church. So I think I've had a job since I was like 15, like in the secular, like at a restaurant, and you know, I've only worked in secular places.
So not Chick-fil-A for that restaurant.
Never Chick-fil-A. I never had Christian music in the background of my establishments. That said, there was a while when Me Too first came out, might have been Instagram, when everyone was like doing hashtag Me Too and then sharing one of their own experiences, kind of like we're all in this together. I never posted anything, but I remember thinking, I think that's just everyone. Like if you don't have, it just seemed too personal to say anything, but it seemed more having only ever been in the secular environment, thinking Me Too. No, that's just everybody. If you don't have a story, it's because you're asleep. Like, no, it's everywhere. Like, I don't see how it's possible, but that's my life.
So this was it just the fact that you were like, well, this is underwhelming, it's not shocking, or it's not sobering, or you just were like,
underwhelming. Oh, I wish I was prepared to, there was one girl on a college campus who I think was originally like a Jane Doe, but she ended up coming forward and she had a story of being raped on campus behind a building, and it was stopped because was it some like Swedish or Scandinavian students saw it happening and ran, like they saw this girl, like a lifeless body, and they ran over and rescued her, and it became a very like huge national story. And that to me was the first time that I really heard someone and a lot of men openly say like, this issue belongs to everyone. Like this stopped because two men saw it and came over. It doesn't matter if she was drunk. It doesn't matter if she was passed out. Like we belong to each other. This is unacceptable. And I feel like before that there was a lot of like, well, I mean, why was she at that party? Why was she wearing that? And nobody really stopped and said, the big national.
Important for moment for me too, Rachel. That was Chanel Miller.
Yeah, that was the first time that it was like I was overwhelmed and shocked by the national responses.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing, you know, to have your experience as a woman and just sort of say, well, this is something I just kind of know goes on, like at a low level, right? A lot of the things that would still qualify as harassment, maybe short of assault, and probably definitely short of rape, but just knowing that we talk a lot, you know. And I think conservatives like to bag on terms like rape culture and things like that. But also the responses that you see are very interesting, where something horrific has happened and we're not even denying the veracity of the account exactly. We're just talking about what this woman may have done, that it's like the burden of proof was on her to sort of say, you shouldn't have been basically anywhere near this person. You can't really live your life. This is not a liberty that you're afforded. And we're not going to connect all the dots, but, you know, we don't have a lot of sympathy for this happening. And I think that was a moment for me, too. I didn't remember this person's name, unfortunately, but I remember just this started an avalanche of these types of responses on social media where we could now see it, where people were. And then obviously we move forward to like the Brett Kavanaugh, you know, situation where he was being... you know, being weighed for the Supreme Court, and all of the things that came out with, was her name Dr. Ford? Is that right? Just ripping her to shreds, her integrity, her character, and, you know, imputing her motives, like she really had something to gain from this. It's very interesting. And I obviously these things have not gone away over time. I've been teaching a crisis counseling class, and we've been going through sexual abuse and sexual assault. And I'm teaching statistics to, you know, my students. And this class is so important, but I hate it. Each week we're talking about something just horrific, you know, like intimate partner violence, you know, like emergency response. And like we had to talk about school shootings last week after whenever you listen to this, know that there was a horrific school shooting in Michigan that's in the news right now, where four students were killed and there may be more to come who are critical injuries. And you know, just one thing after another we're talking about, it's very dark, but I just have been holding on to these statistics a lot. And one of the things that we know with sexual assault, sexual harassment, these things are underreported. That's one thing that's come to the fore, right? We know that the funny thing is a lot of the allegations are on social media and in public discourse that people are overreporting, right? They're stretching events to make them fit a criteria for attention or for fame or something like that. And the thing is, if you talk to anybody who works in this area, we know that they're vastly underreported. So we don't have true statistics on the prevalence of these things, but even the stats we do have are shocking how much these things really do impinge on people. And by the numbers, like you were saying, Rachel, it's not just people out there, it's our friends and neighbors as well, right? Because we just don't have these conversations a lot. We don't open up. I'm curious, we have, I thought it was an interesting opportunity because Brooke, you've worked in, Rachel, you've been around the church for a long time, like you said, but you've not been on God's payroll.
No.
Not been on God's payroll. Brooke is on God's payroll. So it's my
terrible term.
I know. I like it. I don't know. I like it.
It's my crass way of talking about ministry. When I worked for the same church that Brooke worked for a year or two, and that was how I facetiously referred to my position. It was actually a lovely experience. So hear no cynicism there. But Rachel worked for Uncle Sam in the military, and also worked for state government for quite a while. A
slice of corporate America.
And a slice of corporate America. That's true. You worked for Nationwide for a while, as did I. So curious just to hear a little bit of what your experiences have been. Just as a woman, as it comes to maybe just the way you understand that you're a woman, how it's kind of pointed out, differential responses maybe that you've gotten in conversation or in promotion or whatever it might be, but just how did you notice that you were not like men in some of these institutions that you walked among? I'd love to hear some accounts that you were treated differently, that you were seen differently. How did that show up for you? Because I have suspicions of things I've heard, but I've never had that experience of showing up somewhere other than the man that I am. So I'm curious.
I feel like I have two distinct early avenues in my career. So I joined the National Guard when I was 20, which is just statistically the Air National Guard. And which will, like, the numbers later, I guess, will make sense. And then I was, my first job out of college, like a full-time Uncle Sam payroll, was working in the Ohio House of Representatives. And that seemed like a normal job. A lot of the aides to are just like really young. So gender's not a huge thing so much as everyone's like in their 20s. But it was my first time having a boss who wasn't like a restaurant manager, which is its own culture. And he was like this nice family man from like the corner of Ohio, a little more rural, only one Bob Evans in the town. And I loved working for him. Like, I'd never been so happy to have like such a positive work environment. And I was working for him maybe 6 to 7 months before I had to go sub in some other office. And eventually I was hired to go over to the Ohio Senate. But in my exit interview, I was talking to chief of staff. And I was like, I was so happy. I'm happy to have this new position. The guy seems really nice, but I'm just so confused that I do something wrong. He never complained. And his wife had met me and didn't want a pretty girl in her 20s working for her husband. And I thought it was like so hilarious because when you're in your young 20s and you're part of like the happy hour culture, everyone knows people's personal habits, you know, like, and people knew I went to church like four nights a week between ministry and small groups. And like, I'd go to happy hour, but everyone knew like I was going home by myself, you know, like situation. So the idea that I was any threat to her family. So I remember laughing about it. And then like an hour later thinking, I just lost my first job because I'm a girl in my 20s.
Wow.
So I remember thinking, note to self, try and not be that wife when I get older.
It's interesting. That's not the thing that typically leaps to mind, right? Like when you think of any sort of discrimination, you know, you're usually like, we have this sort of set, maybe like a leering guy, right? Like a leering kind of lechy guy in power, abusing power. But it's more insidious than that. I know I'm one that sucks that that happened to you, that that was your experience, but we're all part of this, right? Where there's things that are at play along the lines of our gender, where you didn't just walk into an office, you walked into a narrative, right? That was living in this woman's mind that came from somewhere. So, I mean, I don't know anything about their background, but it just is very interesting that it sort of instantly bucks the preconceived notion of like some lechy guy, you know, like leering, you know, and like exerting power in a, it's more subtle than that. You know, it's often sort of contrasts with that. So
there actually, I was in the interim of me leaving this lovely man's office. I was put in another man's office because he was known for having a problem of sleeping with his staff members. And so I was purposely put in his office because they knew I wouldn't sleep with him.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Also note, downtown and the Ohio legislature is in an office building downtown. And the escalators themselves, which you don't realize until you've like been working there for way longer than you should have realized it. Just the escalators themselves on the left and right of the stairs are angled mirrors, which you don't think about until you're like, until you've been on the escalators for well too long. And you're like, what? And who puts a mirror on the bottom of an escalator that you like go with all your colleagues to get coffee every morning? Just like, you know, a woman did not design that escalator.
Oh gosh. No.
Random.
No way.
Random side note. Wear pants in the Rife.
Wear pants on the ride. My goodness. Goodness gracious. That's really odd. Like that's, yeah, an intentional choice, or at least, no pun intended, a very non-reflective choice. Somebody did not reflect on that very much.
Preach.
Yeah, that is all the way awful. Curious. I want to hear some. I'll bet, Rachel, you may have more tales of military chat than we have time for. But
that's absolutely the truth.
Brooke, I'm curious. You've led not only in the church, but you've led in the church in different cultures as well.
Yeah.
You've worked in ministry. And with some lovely people. So, none of this is to like try to out anybody as being a monster, you know, it's just, how do we experience these things when they don't go to type, right? When it's not the stereotype of a monstrous person abusing power. Really curious how you've sort of understood yourself to be seen differently as a woman and the experiences you've had as well.
Well, yeah, good question. Because I think most of my experiences are perhaps, I would say, more low level awareness of being treated differently, or, you know, eyes glazing over when I start to speak, or people's eyes flitting to different parts of my body, or, you know, little rubbing on the shoulders, or just sort of those sorts of things more like. And yes, most of my pastoral experience has been in another country, not in the church I work in now. But I think where I spent, you know, and there are particular stories there, but more of what I learned through the process was how to play the game a little bit. Because what I noticed was, okay, so if I'm called to this vocation and to work and to lead and to get things done, then I need to figure out how to do that as who I am. And I'm not going to, maybe this is my personality too, but I didn't want to waste too much time just on all these things. I wanted to figure out how to, in spite of them, work. So I remember there's a book, I think that Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, that was really helpful for me. So how do you, when you're at the table, how do you lean in? So I was aware of, you know, I used to talk and would always discount what I would say, like, this doesn't make any sense, but. So I would take things like that out of my vocabulary, and I would show up as strong and with as much authority as I could. I was young, and I was in a woman in a culture where age was more respected. I made sure, especially in situations where I was representing the church with other churches present, where all the leaders were going to be old and white and men, that I would dress more formal, and I would show up in a more formal kind of way, because I wanted to represent the church well. So a lot of my headspace was there. Like, how do I pull, this is not right, this is not just, but until it becomes just, whenever it is, when the kingdom is here fully or somewhere in between, how do we play the game in the meantime? That was where my headspace sat a lot. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I think both of you have worked in for places where, and maybe experienced some of these things, where you believe in the mission overall, right? And that's got to be a hard space to navigate. Exactly. It's like, okay, no, I believe in the church. Like, you know, I believe, like, I want to put the best face forward that I can on this thing that is the church that is imperfect. And I find myself troubled by in some parts, right? Like small, like these experiences where you're like, you said, they're not right. I don't know if you really cared about putting a brave face on the military or trying to keep a veneer on the military, Rachel, but I can see that there would be tension, right? And like navigating these things, playing the game. Rachel, how do you respond to that language of playing the game? I saw you nodding. The audience couldn't see you nodding as Brooke was saying that. What did that do in your mind? Do you agree with that statement? Do you latch on to that? What does that mean to you when you hear that?
Oh, I think absolutely playing the game. And even in within politics, I was even I was part of like a women's leadership training kind of program. It's really amazing. It's like older women in politics trying to get young women in because women are so underrepresented from like the Senate US down to like, you know, local government. And they had a statement, you have to look like a girl, act like a lady, work like a dog, think like a man. Hmm. Just the idea that you have to, like, people want to have to look at you, which is a rant. Nobody thinks that about, you know, men. So even just like politically, that was always, you're always aware of coming across as mature and responsible, and you know, just like the appearance is a really big deal. In the military, I was not trying to break any glass ceilings. I joined in 2000. This is like generations after Rosie the Riveter. And I was the only, they use the word female in the military. I was the only female for my entire time that I served who was a jet mechanic where I served. So there were some specialists, like a electric specialist or something, but the people who travel with the plane, the mechanics, I was the only female. And yeah, I learned early on from basic training, like from basic, you know, there's equal. You're in a group of women, you have a co-team, there are men. And airplane school was the first time that I saw the ratio. So there was, I'm going to get the number wrong, I'm going to undercount, but there was at least like 150 men to one woman in training. So that was how I spent those months, just kind of keeping your head down. And in the military, I feel like there's language parameters on more than this, but
we can put an explicit label on it.
No, you were labeled immediately as either like a lesbian or a slut, because why else would you not want to sleep with some guy?
Huh.
And so it was their way of like, oh, I talked to, you know, Miller over there, and she must be a lesbian, and you're like, yes, that must be the reason that she didn't want to go to the movie with you, you know, like, so there's just like that's just like the base that, and that's like base level, just culture communication. So when you have one chance to make a first impression, which I think is true in any arena, yeah, for men and for women. Mm-hmm. If you want to be taken seriously or whatnot. And so for 6 years, I didn't wear makeup. I was the first person to raise my hand. I went out of my way to be like the least feminine I could when I showed up, for every like kind of obvious reason. But then when I would get out to, you don't know who you're traveling with when you, it's called TDY, temporary duty. And so when you get out to the plane, you have all first impressions. So people see that there's some female on their team and they're like, oh, who, I don't know who you are. So you have to be the first person to volunteer to do all of the work every time. So that you're taken seriously, that you know what you're doing, that, that you're here to be helpful. I'm here to do my job, same as everyone else. But there's an assumption like, why are you here? I don't know you. I don't trust that you're capable. So everybody else gets to kind of sit back and just, I think, be normal. No one's asking like, I wonder if that person, he's got blonde hair. I wonder if he can do this job. Like, right. No one's thinking that. And you can't laugh at jokes, even if they're funny. Like, you have to always kind of have the front that I'm not wearing lipstick. I'm not here to get hit on. That joke might have been funny. I'm not laughing because I never laugh at sexual harassment jokes. I never laugh at sexual jokes. I never, like, use language that might be taken, that I'm one of you, I'm one of the guys. Like, I have to make sure that there's no excuse for me to be in a scenario that I shouldn't be in.
So there, in those spaces, what I'm hearing is there's a lot of vigilance. Like, you are aware of so many things. You couldn't just be unaware or let your guard down or just, you know, make
playing the game, as Brooke said.
Yes.
All the time.
You couldn't be daring. You couldn't just, like, we both know Rachel really well and super, you know, great conversationalist, likes to, you know, make a funny comment here or there, but a lot of that was probably blunted. In these contexts, like, you probably couldn't let your full self out either. That sounds awful. Brooke, I'm curious, you know, I doubt you were in ministry maybe being labeled the same way and having the sort of the same hardcore course conversations, but this idea of not being taken seriously, having to sort of like go show competence up front, not have it assumed, but always have to pay that forward at the front end of an interaction or meeting new people. Can you relate to that in ministry settings? Some of them that you've been in?
Yeah, I think so. I think something that struck me as I listened to you was that you were constantly getting a performance review, like constantly every single person you were engaging with, you had to help show them why you were meant to be in the room and that first impression. And I think I very much relate with that as well. I think what I also really didn't want to do was I also knew who I didn't want to be in rooms, because I did see, now I don't know people's full stories, of course, but I did see some people showing up with a chip on their shoulder. Women who showed up with a chip on their shoulder that were always reminding people of, hey, that comment was sexual harassment or that or things like that. And I also didn't want, I mean, I just try not to have a lot of space for lots of chips on my shoulder in general. That's like a life hope of mine. And so in that area too, I really wanted to be, I wanted to stay soft. I wanted to stay who I was and do the work and lead. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I was a bit naive in that too, where I just didn't give a ton of headspace to it. But I also definitely, there were times where I was really annoyed that I said something, it wasn't listened to, and then that guy said the exact same thing and they heard it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I just have to walk away just feeling a bit annoyed. And then it's helpful then, the fact that I follow God, and then I can process that. And the lack of recognition, like, we see those stories all throughout the Bible of not having recognition. Christ experienced that. He wasn't what people expected to see. And so that's then an internal space that I kind of, had to let stay soft. Mm-hmm. Is that making sense?
It does. It does.
Yeah.
Rachel, there's so many things that come to mind to me as Brooke just shared that, and I'll let you kind of have the last words here as we wrap up, as you are our venerated guest. You got the blue leather sofa in my tiny office. That means you're in a position of authority and esteem. It strikes me that you've been in places, and as Brooke was talking to, these are, corporate America is kind of different. A lot of people might say, well, if you're in an icky work situation, you should just leave, find a new boss, find a new scenario. And we obviously, we would say if it's really toxic and corrosive, yeah, you have to do that. However, you can't just switch bosses and a field like the military, right? You can't be like, I'm not really comfortable with this person or this unit, so I should just be somewhere else. Or even in government, right? You couldn't just necessarily say, there's a lot of other senators around. Maybe I'll just take one of them. Like, if you have career ambition and a career path, or even churches, you could find another church, but it's not that easy. So I'm curious, now we're sort of like, to the listeners out there, how do you feel about those positions where you can't just elect out or opt out? And some of this is going on. How have you dealt with that? And how would you sort of talk to someone who's sort of stuck in that position?
I think that within politics, I've had bad bosses. I did politics for over a decade, and I've had really bad bosses. And when you're elected, it doesn't matter. Like, that's who has that role for 4 years or 8 years. So you have to either work or find a new line of work. Like, that's, you can't just go find, there's very small office staff and very loyal staff. So it's hard to break into those arenas. In the military, every president promises to make changes. The National Guard is unique, when it was why I mentioned it earlier, as compared to active duty, because there's not even a real oversight. There's 54 different National Guard militias in the country. If you're active duty, you might be able to report something to the actual Air Force if you were on their orders. But as the National Guard, it really stops at the governor. There's different rules in each state. And the Air National Guard has seen an increase in sexual assault. You said earlier that people don't even report nearly the amount that's actually happening. But they've seen the number of sexual assault complaints triple in the last 10 years. And nobody has their hands on it. And there's, so you can complain, you can say something, but that's still, you actually signed a contract that you promised to show up for the next 6 years at that place and in that role. You actually spent 1 to 6 months training for that position. You can't even transfer to another specialization. So I just think that it's important to look for people who are maybe ahead of you or behind you. I didn't have any women where I was. As Brooke said, she has Jesus. And so that's super helpful. I found that helpful as well. And I would have liked to not have to have a chip or not to always be aware and just to kind of be in the room. But the 6-year contract at that one location in that one space did not afford me the privilege of not carrying the chip.
I think just given the specialized nature of our workforce, even that's an extreme example, but you know, my wife is trained as a nurse practitioner, right? If you're an attorney, there are certain strictures, like, you know, it's been really popular in the pandemic to see, you know, we talk about the Great Resignation. So we're at a point in history where a lot of people have been resigning their jobs and people starting their own businesses have kind of been at an all-time high. However, we also know historically that most or a high percentage of businesses are started to fail. So we expect that the workforce won't always look the way it is right now with the proliferation of small businesses. As someone who has run a small business for a few years, it is not easy. I never pretended I would be good at it, but it's a lot of work and it can be very lonely and isolating and can fail for lots of reasons. So a lot of us are going to be, by virtue of the schooling we take on, the sort of structures of promotion and the fields we go into, not stuck in some sort of gun to the head sense, but it's a huge cost, right? To transition into another area. So I think your example is one that is just, you know, really, really sort of potent and poignant, because it's like, yeah, we may not be have signed a 6-year contract where we literally can't go because we'll like be in default of a government contract, but we can feel a lot of those same restrictions, right? Like, I've got to pay the mortgage. If I can't find a lateral move outside of my field, I'm like, or to another office, like, who would take me? My resume isn't good, whatever it might be. So I think that's really eye-opening to think about. I mean, I've felt those pressures too, like in terms of my field and trying to switch fields. And there's a lot of things that sort of keep us where we are and explain why we may put up with some things, because you're also talking about trade-offs. Like, I don't want this to be worse for me. It's already bad. It's me and Jesus against the bad, but it could be worse. And playing the game, to me, I keep hearing sort of doing damage control. How can I make things better for myself and not worse? Seems really difficult to do that dance. I want you to put your policy hat on and also speak at all levels, as a woman, as a Christian, as someone who has worked in policy and has that kind of mind. I don't know. It's a very more than this question, but what do we do? Like, how do we sort of like make a dent in this? And you're also a woman who's raising daughters. And I think that must be very interesting as well, to be thrown in this mix with all the experiences you've had and try to raise wise, loving daughters as well, which so far you're doing a great job at.
Thanks.
So kudos to you. But where does your mind go when I say, how do we fix this? Which is a unfair and huge question.
Unfair and huge question. I err on things now. We have a little saying in our house, like, keep it classy.
Keep it classy. I love it.
Which would never, you know, lend itself to somebody deserving any behavior towards them if they were less than classy in that moment presented. I think it's really hard in this culture with there's just a real sense, especially with social media, that you're looking for attention. You're looking to be a YouTube star, TikTok star. Everybody wants to, every television show gets younger and younger for who the parentless children are in the penthouse apartments, like so random on Disney. I do think that men and women, similar to that story that we brought up earlier about the girl on the college campus, like it only made national news because of these Swedish exchange students who happened to see it and they made a big deal about it, about like not letting it go, about making sure it was reported. So I feel like men and women have an obligation in the workplace in general to be aware that bias exists. I think policy-wise, they've tried for probably as many years as at least the last 10. I remember this under like Bush, Clinton, Obama, the other Bush. Everyone has talked about like sexual harassment in the military, which I feel like every arena, like, if I worked for corporate America, if Nationwide said our sexual harassment complaints have tripled over the last 10 years, like it's only getting worse, like that would never fly. Like there'd be Wall Street Journal would, like everyone would be talking about it. And I feel like in the military, they have yet to still allow external, like civilian review of cases. If it's a military issue, it's handled in-house by the military, which means that the person doing the investigation has close connections and professional ties, longstanding, to people who they would potentially be punishing. And it seems like in every other arena, like you wouldn't have a judge who was your cousin over a case. That would be, there's got to be a legal term.
Yeah, well, there's fear of recrimination too, right? Where it's like, yeah, if I step out of, break the code, like my own career could be in danger if I really tell the truth or really take a hard look at this.
So Kristen Gillibrand of New York in Congress is trying to pass yet another law that would address like sexual harassment and assault in the military. And it's just a long line of people who have tried to address this. And there's yet to be a president who has ever said, oh, harassment and assault cases should be handled by external civilian attorneys. It's always internal JAG.
Wow. That is a sobering, and I, I probably have heard that before, but the implications of that have not. I don't connect that to the numbers, right? Like the complaints going up, and you could cynically account for that, saying, well, people just are reporting it more now because people report things more now, or it's become okay to do. Either way, it's a very bad statistic.
Either way, it's bad.
It's very, very bad. Things shouldn't be going up, no matter what, you know, what's moving the needle. That's not good. So policy, it's hard to legislate some of this stuff. I think we've learned through sort of social norms and mores, there's a lot of things, like things go underground. Like we talk about this with racism too, right? Where it's like there is not the prevalence of racial epithets anymore. Like there are some overt signs of racism and sexism that have sort of been taken off the table, where it's like, those are beyond the pale. Like you can't do those things, say those things, think those things aloud, but things persist. So, let's just go back to the, you know, you were taken in this really interesting cadre of women. You talked about where you were in Joanne Davidson's
yes.
group, where she was like, okay, young women in politics, come, we want you to stay here. We want you to make a difference. We want you to survive, not burn out. We want you to be effective. We want you to have careers. So if you were running a group, or, you know, mentoring a woman in her 20s who's coming in green and looking to enter one of these arenas, let's keep the military out of it because it is kind of a special case, but which politics is too. But what would you say to someone who's coming to you and wants to really make a difference? Not just get ahead. Like, I think I want to take that off the table. Like, not just learn to play a game that's going to lead to the most promotion, but actually have a career that feels meaningful, that brings a good sense of meaning and purpose, that they're making a change in the world. Because I think that's honestly where most people are coming out. The students I work with, maybe it's because they're counselors or want to be counselors, that they really do have a passion for justice and want to change the world. What would you say to a woman who wants to make a difference in the world and for people around her? It really does have that ethic of belonging, but also has to deal with some of these vestiges of discrimination that are still very prevalent.
We have a very good friend in common who hopefully will also get to do an exit interview. I feel like I was at a luncheon, a political luncheon, 20 years ago, and the person speaking was a woman, and she was a White House policy expert. And she said, everybody enters politics wanting to make a difference. And you want to do all of these different things. It could be education, immigration, defense, could name the, you know, like a social issue that you want to fix. There's a million of them. If you want to really make a difference, pick one thing that you're passionate about and dig into that one thing. Know more than anybody else in the room about that thing. So read the books, read the articles, subscribe to the newsletters, volunteer in your free time that you have personal experience to go with your heady knowledge, and keep showing up. But I feel like it has to be more than an intellectual aspiration. And I think that that would really play for both genders. But I think that specifically, as a woman, Brooke said that she would, you know, kind of change her clothes, appear a little more professional than casual, and really show up like in kind of command attention. And I think that practically there's not a way to ignore a person who has experience in the trenches of whatever the arena is that they care about. Hmm. Like, be the person who people want to ask a question about when it comes to that topic.
That's really good and also really sad at the same time. Like, it's super empowering, but I hear the echo of lament behind it as well, right? There's that idea of sort of needing to work from a deficit in a way. So that's real talk with Rachel Jones, but I think that's sage and wise, but it also kind of is a bittersweet note to end on. But thanks for the exit interview. I feel like I'm getting some marching orders from all of these things to think about, things to I need, as this podcast closes down, I need to like keep my mind active for the next few years before maybe I start doing another one or have a different project, because Lord knows I like to start things. So good grist for the mill today, Rachel. Thank you so much for stopping by on the big blue couch.
Love it.
Life's not a sequence, but-